report that one, Glenn. There's a little bit more to the story, which I'm not going to get into right now, but you've done a hell of a lot of demystifying. It looks like there is a MythBuster in Massapequa. KC2QIQ. Well done, K2IYW.
I think there's a little bit more to the story as well, which I'd like to bring up at a different time, but I didn't want to eat too much into Mel's time. But I just wanted to at least, you know, kind of give you some of what I saw. And I know we were talking about this last time, and certainly this has kind of opened up my eyes quite a bit. But it's kind of hard to believe that if you have a transmission line as opposed to an antenna mounted someplace, that the transmission line, even in a bad mismatch, is going to radiate anywhere near what the antenna would do. On that note, let me pass it back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ, and then let go to the mailbag.
That's what we're going to do. Now, KC2FFA, I think it is, Foxtrot Alpha, signed in. Charles, if you've got a comment on the things that just appeared, go for it. If you want me to add your name to the list, we've got another schedule we got to go to right now, and I'm not going to be able to hand you up this time. However, if you've got a question and you want to be on the list, you're going to be number one on the runway next Sunday. KC2FFA in Comac, I think it is. No, Brentwood, K2IW. You got it, Charles.
Okay, Dick. I'll wait till next week. No problem. Just a quick antenna question. And let Mel take care of the mailbag. Thanks a lot. Talk to you next week. KC2FFA.
Sorry about that, Charles. We do have a bit of a schedule, and in the past we've been terrible at keeping our own schedule and getting people angry at us. Mel, you've got the floor, and what's the hot item this week? And last week, boy, did we get into antenna tuners, and we just scratched the surface. There's a lot to that one. K2KEY, be careful. K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY, just looking for my stopwatch. Just the real first comment. Quick comment. Do you remember a man by the name of Jim Fisk? Dick, over.
Sure do. Go right ahead and make your comment.
Jim Fisk, who was a silent key many years ago, I submitted a similar article. I didn't have the sophistication of a Rodin-Schwarz analyzer. But I did an experiment where using an antenna system where I compared coax with open line feeders. And I wrote a whole article that if anything, even using that time, the best coax was really the top of the line at the time, that with the open wire feeders, I could see no difference in the performance of the antenna and how I documented it. Number of ways. You know something? He told me, he said that I was literally, I will say it in the best, simplest words, that I was talking through my hat, Dick, over.
Yeah, Jim Fisk, under normal circumstances, who was the technical editor for a lot of years of Ham Radio Magazine, awfully good guy. But like other human beings, nobody bats 1,000. We all have a certain error rate, and you have to accept that. You can try to deny it as strong as you like. You can use all kinds of thousands of words of saying that, you misquoted me. What I really meant to say was so-and-so. We all have a certain batting average, and it's not 1,000. Jim Fisk did some darn good work at Ham Radio Magazine as a technical editor. Please tell me on the next transmission his call letters, because I've forgotten them. But Jim Fisk also made a big error with reference to K2RIW. The parallel kilowatt amplifier, strip line kilowatt amplifier, let me drop. The strip line kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles using a pair of 4CX250Bs running 1,000 watts in and 700 watts out, having 10 watts in and 700 watts out. That amplifier that weighs 3 pounds that you can build with the hand tools in the second bedroom of your house. That's where I built the first one. Not counting the power supply, 1,000 watts, 700 watts can easily come out of that amplifier with close to 70% efficiency. That extremely popular circuit was mailed to Ham Radio Magazine and Jim Fisk in particular. He turned it down as a nut paper. He says you can't put tubes in parallel at a microwave frequency. All the good books tell you that. 6 months later, he read that article in the competitive journal, QST Magazine, and he started writing me letters once per year after that saying, please forgive me, I made a mistake. Over to you, what's his call letters, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
K1FCY, Foxburg Yankee. Jim, I met him one time, most nervous man I ever met. I mean, chain smoker? Unbelievable. You talk about people that destroy their health and why he died, literally a young man, because he incessantly, I met him personally. I knew a couple of people worked with him, and they said, oh, he lives on black coffee and cigarettes, literally. So there's really a perfect example of somebody that ruined their health. But I submitted also another article on an amplifier, funny, that a using Terahorn 3CX800s came out, and I got some of the early versions of them when iMac came out, and sold them very reasonable for ham radio experimentation. I wrote an article how I built a building an amplifier with them, and he didn't like it. He didn't like it. It was poor design, poor this, poor that. So I gave up Dick. So that was my extensive writing for ham radio. Over.
Yeah, you and I both stopped writing for ham radio, both of us because of Jim Fisk, on somewhat different episodes. And so my guess is he's like some human beings. They run hot and cold on certain days of the week, and we all make errors. And I've had to admit from time to time some awful errors that I wish I didn't make, but that's the process of living. Nobody's perfect. I may think we're in the center of the universe. If you had enough knowledge, nobody and no thing is in the center. There's some tiny little chunk of real estate that's truly the center, and no one object can be declared there. Are we at the edge of the universe? And that's also a very rare spot. Nobody is there. So my philosophy, and it may be wrong, is that you can make the assumption that we're somewhere near the center, and for the time being, that particular mental model will give you a reasonable set of answers. Every one of these models that we use to explain a molecule, to explain a transmitter, to explain a feed line, to explain an antenna. Let me drop. Every one of these models is partially flawed. You get down to the molecular level or the submolecular level, there's error. Every model has error. Every mathematical symbol you've ever written down, every formula you've ever written down, if you get deep enough into it, is a good approximation. Nothing is perfect. You think you know the value of pi, and there are people who have calculated pi to something like 1 billion significant figures. Of course, that doesn't make much sense. It's a good way of proving how stealthy is your particular computer, because it can do that. But when you go beyond about 15 decimal places, you're way below subatomic level in the accuracy you're describing, and it's not real. It's not the real world. But it's a good mathematical exercise. So not even pi can be calculated perfectly. And even if you could, you couldn't use it. So everything is an approximation. We have to accept that. That's a philosophy. That maybe you have to go along with it, and your life will be a little bit easier if you accept that. That's a belief. But go ahead, back to your mailbag or whatever, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, back to the mailbag. Yeah, right, that's it. More getting on the soapbox, sort of. Anyhow, last week I had a question. Some people had sent in the questions about tuning. And one of them, a couple of them said that in a number of cases where they have seen, and these are somewhat, I don't even want to come up with the names of these tuners, but they are pretty good, decent equipment. And they found in some cases that people told them that they are receiving them better without the tuner, even though that their standing wave, of course, is most likely on their meter, indicating a lot higher. In other words, when do you use the tuner, when do you don't? Well, to satisfy, actually, I guess you have to say, to satisfy your transceiver, stay below 2 to 1 SWR, otherwise it folds back to power. But is it necessary to use a tuner otherwise? I think it's not going to affect the transceiver, so leave it out of the line, Dick, over.
Yeah, but the need for the tuner, the strongest need for the tuner, is to keep the transmitter happy. If the transmitter sees anything beyond 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, a modern-day, solid-state, no-tuned transmitter, most likely it's going to do something you're not happy with. Goes into the non-transmit mode, cuts back in power, gives you splatter in single sideband, does something that's not great. The transmitter is designed for a 50-ohm load. You would think the transmitter is a 50-ohm source. It is not. If you use the right kind of instrumentation and you look back into the transmitter while it's transmitting, you will not see 50 ohms. But it gives the designed performance, the designated performance, the specified performance, when it sees a 50-ohm load with a low standing wave ratio. So you need the antenna when you're doing the transmitting. Many of these antenna tuners will have a bypass mode, a switch you can flip. If you want to, you can flip that bypass mode switch when you're receiving. And a number of people have asked us, let me drop. From time to time, a number of people have asked us, why when I operate my antenna tuner and I do a good match to the antenna, the receiver signal gets weaker? And I can think of only two explanations for that. One, possibly the antenna tuner has more insertion loss than you'd like. I doubt that. If it runs ice cold when you're transmitting through it, by definition, it's got fairly low loss. And an antenna tuner is made out of reciprocal components, passive inductors and capacitors, and whether the signal is flowing from left to right through the antenna tuner or the signal is flowing from right to left through the antenna tuner, the insertion loss should be low and should be the same. So that doesn't explain it. So I don't think it's insertion loss. However, receivers are amazingly forgiving. You, in many cases, can take a simple clip read that's 3 feet long, let me drop, connect it to the center conductor of your output or input connector of your receiver, and you'll receive HF signals. The S meter won't deflect quite as far, but you'll hear signals. And that piece of clip read on, say, 40 meters as a antenna probably has a 150-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's almost a perfect open circuit radio-wise at that frequency. You could never transmit more than a few milliwatts to that damn thing, and the transmitter is going to complain even if you try, but yet it receives. And what you're discovering is that the receiver is amazingly forgiving. That's one thing. Second of all, remember I told you if you use the right kind of laboratory instrumentation and you look backwards into your transmitter while it's transmitting, what will you see? You'll probably see something close to a 1,000 ohm impedance, not 50 ohms. It's a 1,000 ohm real impedance with some reactance, which gives the proper performance when the transmitter, that crazy transmitter, nearly constant current generator circuit, when it sees a 50 ohm load. Let me drop. By the same token, if you did good laboratory instrumentation measurement and look back into your receiver, your transceiver, but you're looking in the receiver mode while it's receiving, are you going to see a 50 ohm load? Hell no. You're going to see something else. You might, in general, the receiver is a little bit better impedance match than the transmitter, which sounds crazy, but it's the truth. Maybe your receiver, when you look back into it at your particular favorite band, maybe it's a 100 ohm resistor. Therefore, if your antenna has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio of just the right phase angle so that the antenna looks like a 100 ohm antenna right at the input of the transmission line, and you put those two things together, the receiver is very happy and he gets a lot of signal. 100 ohm antenna, 2-to-1 visoir, 100 ohm receiver, they're well matched. You give a nice S-meter deflection. You turn on the antenna tuner, and you take that 100-ohm antenna and bring it down to 50 ohms. That receiver is now looking at 70% of the voltage it used to look at. That's just the laws of physics. And it's going to give you less S-meter deflection. Most likely you will not see a change in signal-to-noise ratio, but the S-meter goes down and it makes you uncomfortable. So there is an explanation. Despite the fact that the transmitter manufacturer, your transceiver manufacturer, let me drop, that manufacturer told you in no uncertain terms, you will use a 50-ohm low standing wave ratio antenna on this piece of equipment in order to get specified performance. They're real persnickety telling you what the antenna is. And you and I can easily sit here and say, well, for them to make that demand, it must be a 50-ohm source when it's transmitting. It is not. And it must be a 50-ohm load when it's receiving. It is not. We've made an assumption. You look at all the data sheets on the transmitter and the transceiver. Nowhere do they tell you what its real internal impedance is in either the transmit mode or the receive mode. They happen not to mention that. They tell you what performance it'll give you when you put it into a 50-ohm antenna. They don't tell you what it is. So I think that's part of the explanation. So you can either accept what's going on, and it's not a real disadvantage, even though the S-meter doesn't move as far, or you can put the antenna tuner in the bypass mode. The choice is yours. It's not going to explode if you do either one of those. That's a strongly felt set of opinions, Mel. K2KEY, I wonder if you've done that experiment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I find that to be a reasonably antenna that's set up reasonably that exhibits an SWR. In fact, putting it in doesn't seem to improve the so-called standing wave of the transceiver to look at one-to-one. All right, another question here. All right, won't dwell too much. We're getting late. I want to hit some of these on the tuners that I've gotten inundated with questions on tuners. I was at a ham fest, and I bought a home-built tuner. The components are top-notch, except the guy who built it in a wooden cabinet. Do you think I should rebuild it into a full cabinet? Is it going to make any difference? Is it unsafe or any problems with using a wooden cabinet for a tuner? Go ahead, Dick.
A wooden cabinet is less than perfect, less than ideal. But I'm going to tell you a story. Mr. Sam Harris, W1FZJ, I think was his call letters, the Swampscott VHF Society, 1963 time frame. The first guy who did moon bounce on ham radio. His 80-meter transmitter consisted of a pair of tubes running at a very high power. I think he was running more than a gallon. The tuning coil for the plate tank circuit was a roll of copper tubing that went between the two tubes. The copper tubing was held with a piece of rope up against the garage wall, the wooden wall of his garage. And by the way, he pulled the rope that went through the coil. He could compress and expand that coil of copper tubing that was the tank circuit between the two tubes. That was his tuning mechanism on 80 meters. Is that a well-shielded transmitter? It occupied a substantial portion of the wall of his garage in between the rafters. It's less than ideal, but if you're smart enough to know what you're doing, you can make that work. So his antenna tuner, let me drop, might very well be in a very nice mahogany box. And if you do a serious calculation of how many wavelengths in diameter is that coil, let's assume it's a pi network, input capacitor called C1, which we all usually call the tuning capacitor, a loading coil, inductor between C1 and C2, and an output capacitor we call C2, which is usually called, that's called loading, and the first one's called tuning. And these components in wavelengths are usually a very small fraction of a wavelength on a band like 80 meters. I'll admit it's getting a little bit hairy when you get up to 6 meters, but at 80 meters, they're fairly small. their ability to radiate a signal is pretty small. Not perfect, but pretty small. When in doubt, it isn't very difficult to take a piece of coax cable, unshield the center conductor and remove the shield, but leave on center conductor and Teflon, or dielectric material, fold it back into a circle of a known diameter, and short the center conductor back to the remaining braid. You've now built a sniffer device that you can now put into calibrated receivers and spectrum analyzers and watt meters and whatever. With that sniffer device, let me drop, you can measure in a way that's almost traceable to the Bureau if you're smart enough. You can measure how much radiation of RF energy is coming off your antenna tuner in that mahogany box. And you can measure it to 1 foot away, 1 inch away from the wood, and so on. You can find out how strong is the signal where you sit when that box is operating. From which you can go to the charts and find out, is that above or below the threshold of alarm? I think there's about a 95% chance it's going to be below the threshold of alarm. You could, if you want to, put another box around the whole antenna tuner. I don't think you absolutely have to. So there's ways of calculating it, there's ways of measuring it, and if the design is done right, it could very well be good enough. Because whether some of the signal, maybe 1% of the signal, is radiated by the box that's in the shack with you, and the antenna that's 30 feet away is putting 1% of its energy into your shack because of what's radiated by the antenna, is there really a big difference? I haven't given you an exact hard answer, but I've told you some of the variables involved and how you can calculate or measure, discuss, and it's a beautiful science project. K2KEY, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think that there seems to be the major worry that if you have a tuner that's in a nice box, and I've seen a number of tuners actually who are built on breadboards, and I don't believe that shielding is necessary. A lot of people, of course, going back to you like 20 meters, but on 75 meters will tell you you're crazy that without it, without shielding it, you're going to have more TVI problems and things like that, that it's going to cause fundamental overload of the TV front end years ago. But the harmonic energy from the transmitter, the tuning network, this is a misnomer. I'm going to say it slow so a lot of people hear it. The tuning network cannot create harmonic energy unless it has bad electrical contact that may act as what we know as diode rectification. And then you could have strong harmonic currents that can be generated in the tuner. But a well-designed tuner, in fact, will help suppress it because, let me let it drop. Now, because even with a low-pass filtering, the tuner, in many cases, will give additional filtering and suppression of the harmonic from the transmitter, so that I don't see any real necessary reason that I have to take apart the tuner case to rebuild it into a metal cabinet, Dick. That's my opinion, over.
Disagree.
Wesley recognized. And I'm going to pass it to you in a second, Wesley, for a comment. And that is, that antenna tuner, an open circuit without a real shielded box around it, as homely as that may look to you from a electromagnetic interference point of view, it cannot create harmonics, like Mel was saying. As long as you don't have scratchy contacts and a rotary switch that's flaky and whatever, as long as everything is solid, it cannot generate anything but the signals that you put into it. Every realistic transmitter is going to make second, third, fourth harmonic and whatever. And if the transmitter is of good design, meeting FCC requirements, the harmonics, all harmonics out of the transmitter are suppressed by more than 60 decibels, and your antenna tuner, when it's operating in the normal mode, will probably suppress those harmonics another 20 decibels, even if it is unshielded. I will admit that if the antenna tuner was well shielded in a metal box, instead of suppressing the second harmonic another 20 dB, it may suppress the second harmonic another 25 dB. You'll get a slight improvement on harmonic suppression. But when it comes to fundamental operation and insertion loss, you'll get a slight increase in insertion loss because the antenna tuner will do, I'm going to pick a number, 1% of the radiation. But your antenna on the end of that feed line, 30 feet away, is also putting 1% of its energy into your shack. And can you really tell the difference? I kind of doubt it. It's not an ideal situation, but it's...
Repeater, time out.
Oh, boy. I did it. It's not an ideal situation, but as long as you're smart enough to know what you're doing, I think it can be done. Let's see what Wesley's got to say on this. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I disagree with both of you, and I believe that both of you are just missing a very important factor. When I was very young, I was experimenting with the wooden box and antenna tuner. What I can tell you is the existence of, when you do not have a Faraday box, the existence of metal objects and the energy that is actually accumulated on these metal objects, the existence of your body or the people that are moving next to the to that box, and these bodies represent capacity and inductance, both of them, make such a big effect that actually you can observe on the TV, the old time of TV, type of the TV, radio, or any other devices. You can even feel the spark on the lamp nearby. I completely disagree with you guys. This is the wooden box. Actually, I did see that. Created, even though that the system was in complete resonance, I did see that effect, the side effect of it. And the additional thing is, if you have a 5 minutes for me, because I've got 4 minutes, whatever, from you also, I would appreciate if you give me on the antenna, if there is a chance, of course. Dick, back to you.
I hear you, Wesley. Okay. Wesley's experience was that a wooden box for an antenna tuner, in his younger days, he was quite displeased with the side effects he had. Waving his hand near it or putting metal objects near it or whatever made changes. Maybe Wesley made his components very large in size. So as your coil gets larger in diameter, as the layout of the wooden box gets more and more dispersed, as the whole unit is laid out on a larger and larger breadboard, so to speak, it will radiate more signal. The majority of what it radiates is a function of how big in wavelength are the components and the distance between the components. Since the wavelength on 80 meters, for instance, is 265 feet, and this box is probably 1.5 or 1 foot wide, so it is almost 1/300 of a wavelength in total dimensions, the amount of signal it can measure, it can radiate, is reasonably limited with a fairly good layout. Now, I will admit that if you lay it out poorly, if you disperse it over a large area, and if you use the worst tuning arrangement, let me drop and explain that. On many antenna tuners, there's more than one way that you can tune it. And if you play around long enough, you may be able to find one of the very poor tuning techniques where the circulating current within the antenna tuner is a very high number beyond what it's supposed to be. In that case, the antenna tuner can radiate 10 times more power than when it's used the correct way. So there are ways of mistuning an antenna tuner that is unshielded that will aggravate the situation. That's the second area where I'm going to agree with Wesley. So, it's not an ideal solution, But there are ways where you can confirm whether or not it's doing what you desire. You can measure. You can study. You can measure. It can calculate. So this is a somewhat deterministic characteristic. There probably are computer programs that will model the situation and tell you how much it's radiating. Yes. Let me drop on that one.
Dick, you're going to be affecting the resonance circuit by your hand when you put it this close enough, or for your body. At that point, you're creating standing wave ratio.
Okay, you can tell that Wesley's got a fairly strong opinion on this one. When you're running on 80 meters and the output capacitor is being set at something like 300 picofarad, that's the loading capacitor, and your tuning capacitor, the input capacitor, is set like 150 picofarad, and your hand outside of that box, which might be 3 inches or so away from that capacitor, is adding 3 picofarads. You add 3 picofarads to 300. You're making a change, but it's not a huge change. So with reasonable layout and reasonable spacing and a small enough configuration of that antenna tuner, I think it can do what he desires. Mel, let me ask you, alongside of what Wesley is saying, when you had your antenna tuner in a wooden box and you waved your hand over it, did you see a lot of change in tuning or just a little bit of change in tuning? What was your experience on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet?
This is K2KEY. Well, I've used many, many tuners, and many of them worked at breadboard situations during, you know, my early days. I could not see by moving my hand any kind of effect. In fact, I'm going to quote Mr. Doug Seymour, W1 Frank Bravo, W1 FB. My experiments, I just dug it out because I know I had a writing on him, a number of things, the man who came up with a number of the tuners and quite well known in the amateur radio literature of years ago. He says, contrary to common belief, an antenna tuner does not need to be enclosed in any metal cabinet. It has nothing to do with TVI or the tuning network. The only thing I do recommend that you do have good insulation between your tuning condensers and the knobs. In other words, you know, put those insulators in the shafts. In other words, isolate the shafts. But also, I have another quote here. I'll be letting it drop. Also from W2DU, Walt Maxwell, also on tuners, the impedance, let me see if I can find the exact section, you cannot adjust the antenna is fixed at a certain height, length, and surrounding. Your variable can be, however, produce an impedance match. I can also recall that the impedance match can be many of complex types or simple types. I have used in the past many of them that actually were hanging from my ceiling with excellent operation. Dick, over.
Let me get one.
Go ahead, Wesley.
This statement that Mel said is true, with the exception of the fact that variables do not change. In other words, if we're talking about suppressing the second or third harmonics, and then we change 2% of the factors because of your body or because of the metal object that move or anything else, then actually you're increasing the not only the standing wave ratio, but you're increasing also the harmonics. So at that point, I've observed many times, and it's not true. As long as the variable does not change, that's what the Mel says is correct. When the variable change is incorrect. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, for the people who are listening, as you can see, there's more than one point of view on this one. Depending on how your antenna tuner is laid out, depending on how it is wired, you can end up with the shaft of the variable capacitor that comes out to the knob. You can end up with the shaft being RF hot. That's fairly undesirable. you'd like to kind of make sure that the frame of the variable capacitor is the so-called grounded terminal of the antenna tuner, assuming it's got a coax input connector. And the same thing when it comes to a knob that either adjusts the switching network to select the taps on the coil, or if the coil is a roller inductor, you want to make sure that that knob is also RF cold. Either that frame is well grounded, or there's a isolating, insulating device. So make sure the knobs are not hot. Make sure that your hand cannot easily come in contact with any of the components. A completely open frame antenna tuner for a smart ham, let me drop, is almost okay, but you got to worry about your visitors in the shack. And that visitor might be an 8-year-old kid who doesn't know. And while you're transmitting, he goes over and touches things. He's not going to die, but he could get an RF burn on his hand. That's not desirable. So make sure that the human beings, even in a mistake situation, cannot come in contact with the RF components. And if things are hot, if you've got a hot knob, there's corrective action. The ideal situation, without a doubt, is a metal box, well-shielded metal box. But for Don Many Guys, Doug DeMore, W1FB, the technical editor of QST Magazine, Sam Harris, W1FZJ, and others, and Mel, K2KEY, have all used, let me drop, reasonably well-designed antenna tuners that were unshielded, and they're happy with the results. So there's more than one opinion on this one. It's not a completely cut-and-dried situation. I think we've gotten that one enough, Mel. And there isn't an absolute perfect answer, obviously. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, to say the final word, I can open this big heavy lid that's on my one of my tuners. You know, I built them all into metal cabinets eventually and all because of, you know, basically it looks like it should belong there in the shack, not a wooden box in the shack. I'm afraid that's from the year, you know, Gimmel, as they say, the old timers, us dinosaurs, or us kids. But now that I can build things correctly, of course I put them in metal boxes. But I will open the lid of the tuner. You can look at the meters and look at anything you want. Open and close them in the big metal cabinet lid, and you won't see any change in that adjustment of that tuner. I've tried that experiment several times on several bands. Okay, let me go on to the next one, Dick. Hold on.
And Dick, if you have a few minutes for me too, I would appreciate that.
Roger. Go ahead, Mel.
I'm picking out all these questions on antennas and things that I have. And here's one that's very interesting. I picked up a surplus antenna system that was used by the Army in World War II, came in a case with a setting up in field. Basically, it looks like that for 40 meters. It's a World War II, and the adjustment says that it has to, you have to adjust for the antenna by use of the variometers, variometers. What are variometers? Oh boy, that takes me, there's another one takes me back, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a beautiful kind of RF transformer. The variometers that I have seen, and they come in at least two types. One type has an outer coil with a resonating circuit, so there's a large diameter coil. I'm going to pick a number here, 3 inches in diameter, and maybe it's a solenoid wound coil, which is 2 inches high, and RF energy is fed into that coil, and there's a capacitor across it which resonates it. Inside of that 3-inch diameter coil is a 2.5-inch diameter coil with approximately the same height and some number of turns, and it goes to two flexible leads to the output connector of the antenna tuner. The knob on the front panel allows you to rotate the plane of the inner coil with reference to the outer coil. When you want very tight coupling between the primary and secondary of that RF transformer, you make the two coils collinear. Call it parallel with each other, but the axis of each coil is the exact same axis. As you twist the knob on the front panel and you rotate the inner coil so that it starts going, so that its axis starts becoming at right angles to the axis of the main coil, the coupling between primary and secondary will slowly go to zero. So you can adjust the coupling coefficient. You've got a tuning capacitor on the output coil, a tuning capacitor on the input coil, and you can change the coupling coefficient. It's sort of like having an IF transformer where you can slowly slide the primary and secondary windings away from each other. And there's a version where you slide them along the axis, but the rotating ones are the most frequently seen version that I've become familiar with in variometers. Is that the kind of variometer you...
Repeater, time out.
Is that the kind of variometer you've seen, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Exactly. In fact, I saw one that was, well, to say the least, humongous. Do you remember the RDF signals that were sent on VLF back in the good old days, Dick, first of all, over?
I remember hearing about them, and I'll bet you they used some kind of a variometer-like device in the receiver in order to do direction finding. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
But the transmitters, those big, high-power VLF transmitters, to precisely match those huge antennas that they use, that's where the variometer was really popular. They had these coils that literally you could step into and had this smaller coil inside in with a shaft, and that's how they did the control of those systems way back. And during World War II, yes, they did produce a number of tuners that were for field use. And they did, that's what they called. They had, actually, they called it a variometer tuner, Dick, over.
So I think you're saying that that allowed them to take almost a random length of wire as an end-fed ZEP, for instance, with this variometer used as a field antenna tuner, and by twisting all the controls, you could probably match a large variety of antennas that were too big, too small, too high, too low, whatever. I'm guessing. Or, in some cases, I guess you could actually steer the beam, and maybe there are some broadcast stations where you're supposed to have the peak of beam in one direction during daylight hours, and the peak of beam in some other direction during nighttime hours. And I'll bet you there were some of those high-power broadcast stations that use variometer to steer that beam. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, exactly. You got to remember that the smoothly change in inductance without having to involve metal-to-metal contact. And it was used on World War II. They had the, basically, if you want to know what the antenna was this portable antenna was basically a inverted L. In other words, you went to the nearest tree or pole and threw the wire up some way up there, threw a rope up, pulled it up, whatever, and then connected it to this variometer. And was very simple. Was better than, well, the modern version came the roller inductor and all. But it was great because you changed the inductance without having to involve contact stick over.
Interesting.
And that's very important. The main thing that that parallel kilowatt amplifier of mine had, mostly recognized, by the way, was the variable output capacitor had no sliding finger stock. It was a flapper capacitor. I was bending a piece of beryllium copper that was screwed down to the chassis, and bending it by pulling on a piece of fishing string that wrapped around a shaft, a dielectric shaft. And so continuous tuning without sliding contacts. When a high power RF current is flowing through a switching arrangement or sliding contacts of a roller ductor or whatever, that's less than desirable. So screw tuners, for instance, on paper they look good. You study what the skin effect is doing to your screw tuner and you realize that the last eighth or sixteenth of a turn of the last thread of that screw is carrying all of that RF current. And if you operate that screw tuner while the RF is flowing, sometimes that screw tuner will weld itself into position because of the way the skin effect creates RF concentration on that last screw thread. N2XJN, K2RIW. Look at your watch.
Yeah, very short comment. For thousands of years, Russians were stealing everything that was American. They were copying tubes, anything possible. The only one thing that happened reverse. Mamdonov, if I remember properly, was the guy who invented the Varyak. Don't confuse it with Varyak. It was known by this name. And the Americans started to use it. But actually, whole Soviet bloc, all of the countries were using that in almost every possible transmitter. Thank you.
Yeah, those things that we call a Variac transformer are very handy. A properly set up Variac will allow you to twist a knob so that the output voltage on a 120-volt circuit will be tunable, will be setable between essentially 0 volts and, say, 140 volts, even though you're putting 120 volts into this Variac thing. And there are real turns of wire and a real sliding contact. So there, some maintenance is required over the years in order to keep it in good working condition. And a Variac like that at RF circuits, at RF frequencies, would be quite undesirable. You're much better off with the variometer than with a Variac.
Thank you for correcting me. But it was known as the name of Variac. Some of the people called it variometer.
Okay, sounds like there's some confusion there, but many of the manuals written now will make it fairly clear what is a variometer and what is a Variac transformer. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yes, very good. And Variac is a very important piece of equipment on my bench, to well imagine, and an isolation transformer along with it. Let me see. Okay, here's one more real quick that, a lot of people say, ask me this question. How come, especially the mobile guys, how come the antenna that seems to have a better bandwidth on the mobile does not put out as good a signal? This is getting back to understanding antennas, and another term that comes in, and that's what we didn't really get to a lot, but I'm afraid if I say it, the Q. Okay, and I know that's going to open another whole Pandora's box of questions, but therein lies Q, Dick. Over.
An antenna with high Q, where Q has many definitions, but one of the definitions is center frequency divided by bandwidth. That's one of the definitions of Q. An antenna with a narrow bandwidth, which means you're dividing by a small number, will have a higher Q. By definition, an antenna with a higher Q has a larger voltage buildup at resonance, a larger current buildup at resonance, larger circulating current. It has the raw ingredients then, by the larger circulating current, to do a good job of radiating. But when you talk about a good antenna and a bad antenna, we're normally talking about signal strength picked up by a remote receiver. That's the usual way we measure it. Let me drop. So if it's signal strength being picked up by a remote receiver, the antenna pattern is very important. And so if that remote receiver is 100 feet away or 10 miles away, there's a very different vertical elevation pattern required to give the maximum signal to those two different locations. And I could use 100 feet away, 10 miles away, 500 miles away. There's a very different radiation pattern. A well-designed antenna with made out of good components, you put 100 watts into it, 99 watts is being radiated into space. Whether or not you get a strong signal at your receiving site is a function of how much of that antenna pattern is aimed at you. So there's a lot of variables involved here. Another one of the variables, let me drop, is your automobile located over sandy soil, over seaside soil, you know, near the beach? Where you put your automobile also has an effect on its elevation pattern, and it will affect how strong is the signal at the receiving site. So these are some of the variables involved. I haven't given a great answer on this one, Mel. What's your spin on this one, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Now, real quickly, I just told them, be careful when they say that, you know, about bandwidth on mobile antennas, because a lot of them that have, as you say, the greater bandwidth has a lower Q. And I always used to kid with a lot of people, and they didn't get it at first, and I'd say, you know, I've got an antenna. Oh, bandwidth is terrific. Goes from, oh, you go down to 80 meters, go up to 6 meters, and it stays perfectly flat. No problem. They say, yeah. I said, the only trouble, it doesn't get out that well. Why not? I said, because it's my dummy load, my cantenna, because the cantenna has a Q of 1. That's the bottom line.
You'd be amazed how many guys were testing a transmitter into a cantenna, antenna dummy load, and made a contact. You know, somebody came back to him and said, hey, I'm hearing your signal. I'm only a mile away, but you sound good into my shack. And the Herbie Snake antenna consisted of a length of wire, coax cable, laying flat onto the lawn. And nobody could complain about the visibility of that antenna. What you guys have heard was TechNet number 1,284 of the series that began in September of 1982. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. Mel's going to give some closing remarks. Then I'm going to come back to Wesley. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, we will try again next week to get some more of this mail. Oh, I've got plenty of it here, Dick. Very interesting subjects and all. And I just wanted to knock off the top ones that were the most predominant questions I've been asked, and we'll just try to do it next week again. Really great that we're able to take some time out and get some serious discussions, and especially this is for a lot of young people. I can say the first time they hear a lot of this, it's very difficult to, you know, comprehend. So that's why I say we got to try to go slow and, you know, get a little bit of a in-depth enough for them to whet their appetite. And also to, you know, look at it further. 73 is all. See you next week. Thank you for the nice emails, the ones that are sending me nice emails. And we'll catch up with you then. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Mel. Wesley, go right ahead with your question. There may be a little bit of an announcement and interruption, but the machine does hang in there a little bit longer. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, I know the time is up, but I think that... just a few words about Mr. Rodin and his discovery. Actually, he was able to, based on the mathematics, he has impact, and he was very much recognized. He was he did a lot of changes in biology, medicine, genetics, astronomy, chemistry, physics, and computer science, and he was able to construct the vortex-based on his mathematics implosion coil. In other words, the concentration of the energy of that coil that is looks like a donut actually so great that it really found a lot of application, a lot of people, actually thousands of people start to experiment with that. And one thing that is very significant, that if you put to one winding of that coil that is that looks like a start, like an ancient symbol started with that never ends. When you draw the star, looks like a Jewish, but the Jewish one is three triangles. And then you put a capacitor, you see actually that when you put your hand closer to it, you have like explosive discharge of the capacitor. And one of the things also that is very important is that while you're putting the load on the end of the second coil, when you have, let's say, the diode in it, instead of creating more energy being drawn from the first coil, you're actually decreasing the energy. It's quite amazing, actually, what this guy did with his changes. And that's it. Another thing is, I have some...
Repeater, time out.
Okay. Yeah, you talked long enough to time out the machine, but I'm hearing you perfectly on the input, so not to worry.
Shut him up.
That man was Marco Rodin. Have to look him up. You're going to be mailing me something, an email with reference to this new antenna, or do you want to discuss it now? The choice is yours. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Well, the thing in regards to the new antenna, I believe it's intellectual property, and if you find that it makes a sense, I believe I'm inviting you and your kindness and your knowledge to cooperate with that. As far as the Mr. Rodin, I believe he is one of the big changes in the world. That's what I believe, and that's what I'm sure about it. The kind of changes that he has made, I could actually apply to the biggest scientific minds in the history. Back to you.
Sounds interesting. I've got a couple of words about Peter Lindman and those three videos that you sent me the website on. Want to hear a couple of words on that one?
Please.
Yeah, Peter Lindman, by the way, when you go to his website and you look at some of his past materials, he was publishing an article periodically, and some of it is unusual stuff. But in the case of his rotary magnetic motor, where he made a lopsided armature, an armature that is kind of like a bar magnet, and he had a pulley on the outside where there were two magnets on that pulley, on that plastic pulley, and those two magnets were actuating a reed switch, magnetic reed switch, which in turn was powering a transistor, and the transistor, when it opened and closed, was putting current into the field of this motor. And at first, the field was being charged by the transistor in a 20-volt power supply, and he showed you the current and the voltage coming out of the power supply. Let me drop. And then also across that field winding of that motor was a diode. At first the diode was going into a short circuit. Later the diode went into a automobile light bulb. And later the diode went into a car battery. And as he went from short circuit to light bulb to battery, the RPM of the motor got faster and faster. The current drawn by the motor got smaller and smaller. The primary current. And I see a method by which there is a fairly logical explanation for that phenomenon. Also, you probably noticed that during those movies, let me drop.
How do you spell his name, Dick?
Lindman is Peter Lindman, L-I-N-D, I think it's L-I-N-D-M-A-N. I believe it's the spelling. Is that correct, Wesley?
I believe it's correct. I have a hard time to remember the writing.
In fact, I'm re-looking them up right now. I'll close this one out, and I'll go to the other one. Yeah, L-I-N-D-E-M-A-N-N. Peter, L-I-N-D.
I got it, doctor.
He calls himself doctor, but when you look at his educational background, I'm not sure he's got a doctorate degree in electrical engineering.
Continue on.
Say that one again, Eric.
Thanks. Continue your conversation.
As far as the doctor goes, I may say that Dr. Seals wasn't the doctor, the guy from England who actually became famous and then... whatever, you know the story. I've got you the video. But at the same time, Mr. Valenza, who graduated just the two classes of electrical school, became a president of